Before we dive into this episode of HRD Masterclass, I'd like to take 30 seconds to share the exciting news that we're now seeking sponsors for Season 5 to release in 2024. This is a wonderful opportunity to support the podcast series and also share your message with 3,500 HRD listeners around the world. Sponsorship options cost just $750 and $600 per episode, and for full details, contact DARREN at allbypodcast.com. Right, let's start the episode.
I look around and I don't see well-trained people. So if we've cracked large parts of human resource development, I don't trip over the evidence of it.
Welcome to Human Resource Development Masterclass, the new podcast series from the Academy of Human Resource Development, the organization that leads HRD through research. I'm your host, Darren Short, and throughout this first series of 10 episodes, I'll be joined by leading authors, researchers, and scholars to explore the fundamentals of HRD and how those are changing in the 2020s. Our focus for this episode is the history and foundations of human resource development, and we'll be focusing on what we mean by HRD, where it came from, how it's developed, and how HRD practices and research can work together. To help me, I'll be joined by two leading scholars. Dr. Richard Swanson, Professor Emeritus at the University of Minnesota in the United States, and Dr. Linda Perriton from the University of Stirling in Scotland. In the first part of the episode, I'll chat one-to-one with each of them. In the second part of our episode, my guests will be together for a group discussion based around their shared passion for the episode topic. That discussion is brought to you with the help of the generous support of our sponsor, Interpretive Simulations. Find out more about their services at interpretive.com. All of the content you'll hear in this episode was recorded during March and April of 2021. Right, let's dive in to meet my first guest. My first guest today is Dr. Richard A. Swanson, who's Professor Emeritus of Human Resource Development and Adult Education at the University of Minnesota, where he served on the faculty for 25 years. Following that tenure, he served as Distinguished Research Professor of HRD and the Sam Lindsay Chair in the College of Business and Technology, University of Texas at Tyler. Dick has published extensively and has consulted with organizations around the world. He's the founding editor of two journals and is one of the Academy of Human Resource Development founders, where he also served as an early president. Dick was inducted into the HRD Scholar Hall of Fame in 2004 and into the International Adult and Continuing Education Hall of Fame in 2001. Okay then. Hi, Dick. Welcome to the HRD Masterclass podcast.
Darren, this is a real pleasure to be part of this effort and to be connected with you in this journey.
I'm really excited that you're here in the first episode, which is focusing in on HRD history and foundations. And I'm keen to dive into talking about the history of HRD, but I'm thinking, given some of the listeners to the podcast may be relatively new to the topic, I'm wondering whether the right place to start is to ask you what is meant by the term human resource development.
Well, as you might expect, there are a number of definitions of human resource development. And I believe that's okay. But the definition that I use is that human resource development is a process for developing and unleashing human expertise for the purpose of improving performance at the individual, group, process, or organizational level.
I'm wondering, for people who are new to human resource development, are there particular terms that they might know? Are there particular labels or terms that they may have come across that are often associated with HRD?
Yeah, absolutely. Again, my definition says that HRD is a process. And the reality is that in organizations, that HRD process could be called a number of things, from everything from organizational learning to a corporate university to training and development. Subsets in career development, management development. And so there are a lot of terms within enterprises that embrace human resource development.
So having defined HRD, I'm interested where HRD came from. What are its core origins, and then how has it sort of evolved over time from then to now?
You know, I want to back up a little bit. I'm going to answer that question, but it wasn't long ago when a lot of the elements that maybe the listeners of this program know that are available. It wasn't long ago that we didn't have a HRD program in a university with that name. We didn't have a scholarly association. We didn't have a research journal. We didn't have a research handbook, and we didn't have a foundational text. And so a lot of these elements are relatively new to the profession. But now I'll drop back to World War II. And I look at World War II as being the origin of contemporary human resource development. And in 1945, Channing Dooley published a Training Within Industry report describing the massive effort that took place during the wartime that resulted in increased productivity through performance-based training, quality improvement, and human relations. And these elements are present today in human resource development. Of course, back then, it wasn't called human resource development. And that term didn't surface, to my knowledge, until 1964, when that term was used by Harbison and Myers. Now, these were economists that were focused on developing nations, and were talking about the need to help these nations develop their human resource. And they used the term human resource development. And later in the 60s, in 1969, Len Nadler at George Washington University is seen as a person in the profession that made the term human resource development popular.
In that period then, from the Second World War through to the late 60s, was there a form of professional association and education happening at that point? It just wasn't labeled HRD.
We had organizations like the American Society of Training and Development, really was given birth following that Training Within Industry project during World War II. But again, these were practitioners, and the journals were or magazines, if you will. There was not a body of knowledge that was systematically reported and held in things like handbooks. There also was Training Magazine, not an association of people, but it was from a publisher. And these groups continued on through the 60s. And in the 70s, people in the university became committed to what was training and development, or called adult learning in the workplace, or called career development. These people were anxious to make some change about the systematic knowledge base of the profession, and to gain recognition of their particular academic interest.
When that happened, at that point, there's clearly interest within a group to more or less, I guess, I was going to say mature the profession, but it's almost at that stage, I would imagine, to create the foundations of a profession. So when you got to that point, what were the core focus areas initially within the group that were thinking we want to define and mature a profession that's called human resource development?
Probably the most dominant thread had to do with systematic training, which had to do with performance-based training. And some of that was spun off of the work of like B.F. Skinner. And then there were others who thought that committed to educating the workforce in a broader sense. So these were mostly revolving around learning. And so there were these people from multiple academic areas, multiple preparation in their own lives, who were adding to the formula, We're helping advance the profession, not necessarily working together, but creating pieces that that were complementary. So this idea of having a profession that would ultimately be accepted as a discipline in the academic world, it became a journey for a cadre of people. Getting named degrees in universities was really important. We had no scholarly association, just trade groups. And they would be either ASTD or Training Magazine would run conferences and workshops, but there was no research group. In 87, a group of us created the University Council for Research in Human Resource Development. There were only 14 members of doctoral degree granting universities. This organization helped, really helped a little bit later on to form the Academy of Human Resource Development. But in the interim, in 1990, out of the research center we had at University of Minnesota, we got the Human Resource Development Quarterly, the research journal, approved. And it was co-sponsored by ASTD, and then ultimately co-sponsored by the Academy. The Academy of Human Resource Development didn't exist yet. And so this journal was kind of seen to be an easy choice for ASTD because they saw professors as just kind of like a small special interest group. It wasn't going to cost them much. They got support from a publisher, which was Josie Bass. And the president, Josie Bass, was Steve Persante. And Steve Persante, his name pops up over and over again as helping to grow the HRD profession. But so the HRDQ actually became wildly popular right away, which was a shock to the leaders in ASTD. So that was very exciting to have that happen.
Yeah, that must have been an exciting time. So at that point then, and at this stage, I get we're like early 90s. At that point, we're starting to see like groups come together with a shared passion or commitment towards research for HRD. And we're also seeing the first journal that's dedicated to research on human resource development. At that stage, what was the thinking around the significance of research? As in, presumably a number of things could have been used to try and move HRD forward, but research was seen as the core one.
As you might guess, the practitioner journals over the years were publishing stuff that wasn't either effective or wasn't really core to what the profession was trying to achieve. So
like the latest fad or something.
Very faddish. And they also published good stuff, but it was all mixed up. A research journal has a peer review where people who are also experts get to review manuscripts before they're accepted. And so this had to do with having quality between the academics within HRD and within the larger academic community. I mean, certainly the people that were professors and researchers interested in human resource development wanted to have recognition and a platform within their university. So having a research journal, really critical. And as I mentioned in the opening comments, at this point, universities had degree concentrations or degree titles called HRD. And so there was some definite movement going on. And so in 93, we took the next move, and that was to the year that we gave birth to the Academy of Human Resource Development. And Wayne Pace was the founding president of the Academy, but he was the major force that behind the birthing of the Academy, along with Karen Watkins. Karen was representing kind of the professors network of ASTD. And then I was representing the University Council for Research in HRD. And Wayne, his academic home was actually in a communications, a college of communication. And so the three of us created some delightful energy. We were also very good friends.
So at that point then, we've got an organization whose mission is to advance HRD through research. And we also have a research journal in the form of Human Resource Development Quarterly. So at that stage, what were the main focus areas in order to continue the maturity of HRD as a discipline? Now you have one journal and an organization. What became the focus at that stage?
The existing mission of the Academy right now, leading the HRD profession through research, was voted on back there in 1993. So it's been the focal point of the Academy as we continue to do our work and grow the profession, invite and bring in doctoral students in HRD and treat them as colleagues. I think earlier on I said that a legitimate academic discipline has named degrees, has a scholarly association, has a research journal, and they have a research handbook. Well, lo and behold, in 1997, we produced with a Barrett Kohler publisher, and again, Steve Brisante was behind us and supporting us, a human resource development research handbook, linking research and practice. And that got sponsored by both the Academy and ASTD. And so that was another step in our maturation.
So at this stage, then, we've got journals, we've got an academic conference where research is being presented, we've got an organization with a mission to advance HRD through research, we've got a research handbook. Taking a look at all of those, was the thinking that the ultimate goal was to then impact practice, i.e. to generate the theory and the research in a way where practice would ultimately be influenced by better theory and research?
Absolutely. I guess for a lot of us, we were thinking that if we got our heads straight in terms of the scholarly basis for the knowledge base of the field about how we accept ideas and promote those ideas, that if we do that with high integrity, it's going to cascade into practice. In 1999, I'll jump ahead, we started another journal, which is called Advances in Developing Human Resources. And this is a journal that was designed specifically to talk about and deal with issues of theory to practice. So we had a view of having the research leading the field, and creating that Advances journal was that was part of it. Prior to that, we started another journal in 98, which is the Human Resource Development International. And I shouldn't say we, it was in cooperation with the University Forum in the UK, and Monica Lee was the founding editor of that journal. And that, again, broadened the footprint of the field. Shockingly, we went from the idea of not having any scholarly output publication in 1990 to the point of in 1999, we had four refereed scholarly journals. Just kind of incomprehensible and wonderful. And again, these were exciting times.
Oh, yes. I think the amount of energy and effort and time that went into seeing a quantum leap forward during the 90s. One of the questions I wanted to ask about was the focus of this episode is history and foundations. And I'd be really interested in your perspective on what the foundations piece means. When you think about the foundations of HRD, what do you think of?
Well, I think it's a very important question. In 2001, actually published the Foundations of Human Resource Development, first edition textbook. And right now I'm finishing up the third edition of that. As you might expect, having definitions is really important in terms of foundations. And there are a whole range. There are actually some journal articles that just review all the different definitions of human resource development. And there, again, there are differences and they're more alike than they are unlike. But coming together with definitions that are understood and acceptable to large groups of people is really important. The other thing that ultimately becomes important in terms of foundations is to articulate the underlying theory. What is it that describes this phenomena? And that theory ultimately has to match up with practice. Some fields don't have that dilemma. I mean, we're in a field that is an applied discipline, and as an applied discipline, we have to have integrity in both worlds, the academic world and in the applied world. So we need to have some angst about how the theory informs the practice and how the practice informs the theory. Most of us in the profession who have been active with applied research in the field, we work with organizations and practitioners, and sometimes we learn, well, I say sometimes, a lot of the time, we learn about how things work before we can explain them. So we discover things in practice and then go, well, what's really going on here? And we pull back and study it. And so So some of the best ideas have just popped up out of practice and then ultimately get explained. We need a toolbox in the profession that has credibility in terms of its understandability and in terms of its ability to function and work and to do what it purports to do. So we're building this toolbox all the time.
So it sounds like a journey of understanding what works and why it works.
Oh, yeah. I think it takes a special person that wants to answer both those questions.
Yeah.
Or a partnership. I mean, a whole lot of our effective scholars are, in fact, in partner with effective practitioners. At a practical level, a lot of our students in universities aren't going to be scholars, they're going to be practitioners. And a lot of them, if they are sympathetic to the foundations of the field and the questions and how things work, become great partners with the university, either the university professors or the advanced students that are doing research. So they're working together as both practitioner and researcher to help advance the field. And that's a delight. It's an actual delight. And it's a feature of human resource development that I think is quite unique.
Yeah, I'd agree. Well, Dick, I've really enjoyed our conversation. Thank you so much for spending time one-to-one talking about the history and foundations. And I'm going to ask if you're willing to hang on, because we're going to chat with Linda next, and then you, Linda, and I will be together for a group conversation at the end of the episode.
That sounds great.
Okay, my second guest for the episode is Dr. Linda Perriton from the University of Stirling in Scotland. Originally from Australia, Linda started her professional life in UK financial services, working first as a plant and engineering underwriter before joining a short-term technology-based training project that was her gateway into management development and coaching. She gained her PhD as a mature student in 2001 and switched to a career in higher education. Linda's main area of teaching and research interest is learning and development, specifically critical approaches to reflective practice and management education. She also writes on the topic of how women have historically acquired training in management, looking at practice as far back as the 18th century. Linda, welcome to the HRD Masterclass podcast.
Hello, Darren. Thank you for inviting me.
Well, I was thinking that there are lots of places where we could start. And I'm wondering whether perhaps it helps us to begin by exploring HRD history in the context of the conversation that we just heard with Dick. Now, my assumption is that the history of HRD tends to look different based on someone's experience and location. For example, somebody in the United Kingdom will view the history of HRD differently from somebody in the United States. I was therefore wondering what the history of HRD looks like to you, given your experience.
Dick's account was really interesting because it was like hearing a story I wasn't familiar with. And I didn't recognize it as the story of my journey in HRD. And that made it really interesting because it was obviously a foundation story. And it's a bit like when you ask somebody, how did you meet your partner? Or how did you end up working in X? There's obviously a way of explaining how things come about, which has a kind of familiarity to it, to the people who are in that reality or in that tradition. So I knew I was hearing a really interesting story of the foundation of HRD in the United States, but I didn't recognize it from my perspective as something that resonated at all points. There were points where it connected. And I thought that was really interesting because he was talking at one point, I think, about the recognition of having named programs in universities and how important that was to the building of a profession and a professional identity. And I was thinking, actually, there's probably really low name recognition of HRD in UK universities, even at the kind of the course level. HRD, I think, is used if academics want to link to the AHRD in some way. They might have a professional connection to it, or a particular textbook has that name in it, and it makes it easier to kind of structure everything around HRD. But Dick was also talking about all the other ways you can describe it: learning and development, training and development, employee development and training, workplace training, whatever. And I think those terms are much more resonant in my experience, at least. And those definitions matter. Those words matter. So one of the first things I ask my students to do on a learning and development module is to go look up the Google Analytics page and see what different countries search for in terms of search terms in this general area. So do the Irish Google search for talent management a lot? What do the Australians look for in their Google searches when they're thinking about learning and development, management education, those sorts of things? Because I think it's really important that we understand that there's an ebb and a flow and a kind of a history to how we use terms and why we use terms in different parts of the world.
It feels to me as if certainly in some countries, and I think the UK is definitely one of those, that HRD has really struggled to create an identity outside of HRM, that even in an organization, the HRD team, however it's labeled, is typically part of the HR function that is dominated by HRM, with employee relations and HR business partners and talent acquisition. How have you experienced that in your career as a scholar and as a practitioner, that tension between HRD and HRM?
I live that tension. I teach HRD in a HRM degree, if you like. I see them as very distinct and different theoretical bases. And so I live that tension. And I've lived it professionally as well, because when I first became a training professional, my professional body in my home was the Institute of Training and Development. And then lo and behold, they went into a merger with the Institute of Personnel Management, and that became the UK's Chartered Institute of Personnel and Development. And I think at the time, there were a lot of training professionals who felt the danger would be that we would be the poor relations in that particular hookup. And I think that's probably proved to be right, but not for the reasons I think we feared at the time. What I think happened around the same period, so we're talking about 94, I think, was that HRM, or industrial relations, was starting to lose its grip in a lot of Anglo-UK countries. So those who were kind of built on the UK model of industrial relations as well. So I put into that Australia, New Zealand, those sorts of countries. HR was losing its traditional role of looking after unions and managing the union employee-employer relationship in a kind of very structured way. And I think from that point on, HR has been looking for its unique contribution to the workplace. And every so often it kind of stumbles across a new one. So, you know, we're here in order to increase the performance of the organization, or we're here to increase its ability to change, or we're here to increase the ability of people to adapt and train and kind of be that engine of growth in the organization. And I think over time, what it has just done is kind of the mission creep of HR as it looks for a kind of another way of selling itself to the organization, has acquired more and more of learning and development, the HRD side of things, I think to the detriment of the underlying theory and development of a lot of the practices around training and development and OD in organizations.
Presumably because this is an applied field, and we've got far more practitioners than there are researchers and scholars. I'm thinking, therefore, that a fair statement could be that a lot of what we've learned about HRD, we've learned by people practicing it, that they learn what works by doing it, by doing HRD in practice, and they share that with other practitioners in magazines and in conferences and that sort of stuff. Does that feel a fair statement to you, that a lot of what we know about HRD sort of comes out of that area of practice?
I don't know. I think that would be a nice story. I'm just not sure that it feels true from observing it. My sense is that if I go to the local branch meeting of the CIPD, which I do, and they say to us, well, next in 3 months' time, we're going to be visiting this really interesting, innovative company, and they're inviting the local branch members in to have a look at their great training program that they have. I go to those like a flash. I can't keep away from those sorts of things, because I want to see what people are talking about learning and development in organizations. Yeah. And you go there and they proudly tell you about the fact that they have bought the license for ABC product, Acme training product. And this is how they use it. And they'll spread out a kind of a multi-colored plastic sheet on the floor, and they'll explain that some people are squares and some people are triangles.
And some people are blue and some people are red.
Yeah, that sort of thing. And I stand there and I worry for them, because I think HRD academics have had no influence in the creation of Acme Company's training product here. And yet here is a fairly influential, fairly going quite well company in the local area who are using this product without challenge from the academics, without input from the academic research. And I think if I think about my time as a training practitioner as well, when the latest catalogue came in, you were all over it. And as a practitioner, if you didn't have an academic background, and I didn't then, I had a vocational qualification in instructional design, you were very easily swayed by commercial products. And so what I think is happening is there's a great commercial lock-in in training and development, and that's increased probably since we got rid of a lot of in-house training cohorts as well. So around the same time in the mid-90s, I think a lot of large companies, one I was working for included, were divesting from their in-house training functions and outsourcing it. And therefore, the people who work in learning and development a lot of the time in organizations are commissioners of training. And they've got the same catalogs. They've got the same kind of commercial interests who are knocking on their door and saying, can we give you, you know, this training in this particular area? It's not bespoke. It hasn't grown up with what that organization understands its mission to be, or how it thinks of its culture or anything like that. It's a product they have bought off the shelf. And so I see a sense of a very vibrant commercial sector which is selling into organizations.
Dick referenced that as well, didn't he? He talked about the fad, or the faddish nature of HRD. And it sounds like from what you're saying there that what we see a lot of is HRD leaders in organizations, in the absence of having their own teams to do needs analysis and instructional design and facilitation, are essentially cherry picking from whatever fads that external consultants are putting out into the marketplace right now.
Yep. And why wouldn't you? In the absence, and it's also part of the historical view of HRD and organizations as well, is that about, I don't know when it stopped, but certainly in the time that I was employed as a trainer, there was a greater willingness by UK companies to offer their professional HR and HRD staff the opportunity to gain higher qualifications. So my MA was a sponsored one by my organization. Those have all but disappeared from the world of corporate life now. And I think that's a real shame, because it was very much seen as, please go away and become informed and bring back that kind of theoretical challenge back into the organization so we can do things differently. And when we stopped having a lot of part-time practitioners on our PG programs, on our postgraduate programs, we lost a lot of that movement of academic ideas back into the practitioner world. And I think it's become more and more difficult to cross that boundary since in any meaningful way. And I think we should really regret that as well. So when I remake the world, in the end, I'm going back and I'm going to reinstate those sorts of practitioner part-time programs where we can send staff within organizations for training in universities to gain higher degrees. I think it was really useful. I think we've lost something really valuable over the years.
Yeah, because we talk occasionally about the concept of a bridge between research and practice. And so as you're talking, I'm picturing that bridge and the idea that, you know, we want research and theory from the world of academia to influence the world of practice. And then we also want, going back the other way, we want the world of practice to be influencing research agendas and to provide research partnerships so that applied research is happening in organizations. And it feels as if we've known that bridge is important for decades, but still really struggle to move stuff back and forth across it.
And I think that happened a long time ago. I think there used to be a sense where you would call on your local university as experts to come in and talk to you. I think there was a point when the big consultancy companies started to really flex their muscle in the market that we lost out to commercial providers on that front as well. So we don't give advice. We are not the first people you would call if you have a problem and you want to work through it. And that's been a shame as well. So we've kind of been sidelined, I think, in a lot of thinking through of HRD practice on the ground. I worry a bit about that, actually, and that we don't seem to have much ability as an academic professional area to push back against that. And I was, what sprung to mind was, and it's good to mention because it's a HRDI article from 2012. It's one by Richard Waters, where he talks about learning style instruments and the reasons why research evidence has a weak influence on practitioner choice. And he talks about things like brand strength, cognitive lock-in, and consumer lock-in. And I think what we see a lot in the world of practitioner training and development is a lot of consumer lock-in to products, and they're fairly resistant. And we don't have any in to that as academics, I don't think. So I see HRD practitioners doing very nicely without us in terms of our influence on practice. And I see the commercial world having much greater influence than we do.
Yeah, because even if an organization wasn't reaching out to a university, at the very least, we would hope that there's somebody in the organization who is an educated user, as in they're able to look at various HRD solutions that are available and ask good questions like, what's the research or theory that underpins this practice? But it feels as if those practitioners aren't there asking those questions.
No, and we're not able to have that contact with them through education and through sponsored places and through the idea that you should be investing in your people, because I think a lot of that sort of investment is now kind of seen as investment in your own future. So it's become individualized in terms of, well, of course I would pay, you know, how many thousands of pounds or dollars to get a master's degree in this, because it will benefit me and my career and my future. Whereas we used to have conversations with organizations where they said, actually investing that sort of money in our professional staff actually helps the organization. And I don't hear that discourse much anymore, if at all.
Now, of course, you offered one potential solution, which was you recreate the world for us. And I would vote for that. But if that doesn't come about and you aren't able to go back in time and recreate the world, what steps do you feel like we could take at this point to try and get the world of HRD practice to be better educated users of the solutions that they're buying?
I don't know. Can we leave that one to the discussion with Dick afterwards?
Absolutely. Yeah, like I don't have an answer either. So if you don't and I don't, then it does sound as if it would be interesting to have a conversation with Dick about that.
Well, at least we're comfortable saying, don't know. I don't know. Part of it, obviously, is about everybody being a thoughtful practitioner. You don't have to be university educated to be thoughtful. You just have to be curious and a little bit resistant to being told that the world is a particular way. And I think anybody who has the ability as a child to say, but why, should be keeping on saying that regardless of the position they find themselves in later in life, and especially in professional life. So I would encourage awkward people in organizations to ask, but why questions.
Well, I guess given that HRD is like evolving, it makes me think about, you know, what we need to find from the past that can inform or guide that evolution. I suppose essentially, what don't we know about HRD that we should know that can guide that evolution?
We don't know much at all. I think that's the really surprising thing. I mean, if I think about, you know, my distant retirement and what I'd like to do with it, I think what I'd really like to do is write the history of training and development in the UK or a particular country. We don't know a lot of things. We don't know what's the real link between, I mean, Dick mentioned World War II in his comments, and I was thinking, well, a lot of the training college idea that we had in the UK up until around 2000 was very much based on army training colleges, I think. But there's no real good history of how military training and commercial training in organizations overlaps either. There's so many things we could usefully know about our past in training and development that we really don't have a very good idea of. And I'm one of those people who believes that knowing about the past is really useful information for the future, because we need to be able to put things in perspective and to be able to understand how our approaches to HRD and training development shift as all those other things around us shift: government policy, the economic situation, ideas from economics about who's responsible for training. Is it you as the individual or is it the company? Ideas about pooling of skill in particular industries, which have seemed to have gone with industrial training boards and things like that. There's so much that we could join the dots between and have a much better view of what might be going on at the moment in order to predict and put our research in the right sorts of areas at the time that it would matter.
Well, Linda, my guess is we could carry on the conversation for a lot longer. And the good news is we're going to be able to do that because we'll have Dick rejoining us. But I did want to thank you so much for our one-to-one. It's been great having this conversation with you.
I've really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Thank you so much indeed. We'll take a short break and then we'll be back with Dick in a moment.
Thank you.
Up next, we have the group discussion, where my guests are together to discuss their shared passion for the episode's topic. This discussion is brought to you thanks to the sponsorship support of Interpretive Simulations. Since 2008, students and trainees have used Interpretive Simulations HR Management Simulation, where participants are tasked to make challenging decisions at the HR director level in a simulated environment. Students must build a strong HR function at their simulated medium-sized organization and wrestle with the challenges of staying on budget. The simulation makes the connection between concept and practice while students learn by doing. It comes with assignments, mini cases, and quizzes to reinforce core HR principles. If you'd like to receive faculty access to review the HR management simulation, visit them at www.interpretive.com and fill out a demo request.
So welcome back to the HRD Masterclass podcast. As you know, the focus for this episode is the history and foundations of HRD. And I've already met one-to-one with both Dick Swanson and Linda Perriton. And for this final section of the episode, we're all together for our group chat. How about we start by looking back at the history of HRD? And I know that Dick particularly touched on the role of the military and the impact of wartime periods. So I'm interested to put that into context. When you think about that, how significant was the military and wartime periods in creating the HRD that we see today?
I have a very definite position that this training within industry project that took place in the United States was a watershed for the field. The fact that the federal government ended up appointing a high-level training board that required suppliers of military goods and services to have very thorough and systematic training and development in their organizations if they wished to still stay in business with the government. I really see that as being extremely important in terms of systematic training, in terms of human relations, and in terms of the OD performance redesign improvement efforts within our field. And I think, Linda, you have some other observations.
I do. I think that whole wartime training period was incredibly important. The thing I'm interested in, I suppose, is the end of the war period, World War II, the 39 to 45 war, because we have to talk about it differently around, you know, not everybody knows it as World War II. But that kind of interwar and the last years of the 39 to 45 war, there was lots of planning going on in the UK about how industry and how important it would be in the post-war reconstruction period for there to be trained managers. So they talked about setting up the Henley College. So lots of industrial training colleges based on the Imperial Defence College in the military in the UK at that time. So I think there's an undercurrent of the military and our idea of leadership in the military that certainly underpinned leadership training in the immediate post-war period. And I think probably still influences it in terms of a lot of the theory that's still knocking about now.
Yeah, I would think some of the developments in the military around the concept of strategic planning, scenario planning, those tools had been refined and developed sometimes solely in the military, and then have gotten tossed over the wall. And some of those tools relate to human resource development, and we've taken them on to be the people that are spreading that information in the private sector.
I asked a question about military because Dick had mentioned that in his one-to-one. So it feels right, Linda, to pick on something that you said in your one-to-one. And it fascinated me that you talked about wanting to reinvent the world. It sounds such an attractive idea. What I'm wondering is, if you did that, how would the history of HRD change, and why would you change it?
I would change it because I think we have lost something. I mean, I don't want to get too nostalgic about the 1980s because my hairstyles weren't good back then and the fashion wasn't great, but we lost, I think, a little bit as we move forward, something about the willingness of industry and large organizations to sponsor individuals who are working in HRD and HRM within it, to sponsor them in terms of their relationship to theory, to higher education, to their own education and what they would bring back to organizations. And I do feel a little nostalgic about that. I think I look around and I don't see many people like me. And I mean, I don't mean that in a kind of a vain sense, but in the sense that who were occupying the same positions as me when I did postgraduate study as a professional, as a working practitioner. And that worries me a little bit because I see a lot of young people who are starting out in their careers, but I don't see in my classes anymore people like myself who are working in that area and have been, if you like, given day release occasionally to go into higher education, to come back into industry with good theoretical foundations of their practice.
You know, to tailgate on Linda's nostalgia for the 80s, that was a time I'm very, very aware of the business and industry here in Minnesota, when corporations changed in the sense that they eliminated the overriding concept that you were going to be in this corporation for life, for your whole career. And I watched management development programs get minimized because the sense was that these people that would be developed would not necessarily be with that company anymore. Mm-hmm. And so things eroded as the speed of change and the unpredictability of change among the corporate world, it eroded in terms of supporting some of the employees that Linda's talking about, that were involved and responsible for human resource development in their companies. So things got minimized a bit. And alternative strategies came into play, one of which was to put greater responsibility on the individual employee for their own development. So that was quite a shift.
It's a shift because it shifts the financial responsibility and for that as well. And that's changed a lot of how we might think of our own development and how we and who's innovating in organizations and for what purpose as well. So I think in putting the emphasis back on the individual and also for them to pay for their own development, it shifted when development happens for a lot of people. It shifts it to the beginning of their career. It means that we don't have a lot of experience in the classroom when we're talking about HRD or HRM. It also means that I think the individual is less likely to hang around and give of themselves and of their own development to the organization in terms of innovation as well. So I think ultimately organizations lose out, but they lose out on such an extended timeline that they don't notice what it is that they're losing.
In listening to your answers there, I'm wondering, How do you think the changes you're describing in the workplace and in education have impacted the challenges that HRD faces in bridging the worlds of research and practice?
I think it's really difficult if you are studying a postgraduate degree as your entry point into the profession, because I think your focus is on what do I need to learn and what do I need to do in order to enter, the first step on the ladder and things like that. That's very different from having a class full of people who are mid-career and who are already perhaps running their own business or are running or are close to being a senior consultant or a senior trainer in an organization. I think they're very different conversations, and I think they're very different research anxieties and playfulness, I think. I think you have to have a certain amount of perhaps residual interest or a puzzle that you come to higher education with as a mature and practitioner experienced student. Something that's bothering you, something that you've never quite solved or is kind of niggling away at you. Those are great research bridges between practice and HE because they are a partnership of you helping somebody to work through a particular fascination or a particular problem.
You know, I agree with you, Linda, and I agree with you to the point that in the programs that I've been associated with, the academic programs, we required our students to have work experience in the field, in the discipline of human resource development. And that if they didn't have it coming into the program, we got them enrolled in an internship. And some of our internships would last long periods of time, and they could be for a year working in HRD efforts in that corporation, and then bring that back to the classroom and raise questions that not only could be verified through the literature, but verified through their own experience. So I think as an applied discipline, having experience, Even small experiences are really important.
As we've talked through all of this, it strikes me that there's a fair amount of agreement between the two of you on all the topics we've been talking about. And so I want to pick on something where it felt like maybe there wasn't agreement, because when I had the one-to-one chats with each of you, I think Dick was talking about the significance of progress that there has been on research and theory development in HRD over the last 20 years. And I think, Linda, you were calling into question, how much do we really know at this stage? Mm-hmm. And I don't know whether the two of you actually do see it the same and you're just putting the same thing differently, or whether, in fact, there is a difference in how the two of you see the amount that we really understand right now about HRD.
I think we know a lot. I don't think that we have communicated that systematically to our profession. We tend to talk more about the differences than the things that we agree on, have in common. So I believe that we have a body of knowledge that undergirds our discipline that is quite powerful and available, and that it is not easily available.
I'm just wondering how much of a pessimist to be. I don't agree. I look around, even a fairly advanced industrial economy like the one I live in, and I don't see well-trained people. I don't see exceptional service. I don't see exceptional levels of competence in fairly even routine roles in society. So if we've cracked large parts of human resource development, I don't trip over the evidence of it on a day-to-day basis. I have absolutely no doubt that we have thoughtful, well-educated practitioners in some areas of society and of industry working really quite hard and doing good things. But I don't think we have made a breakthrough in terms of, if we do know stuff, we're keeping it secret, it seems to me, in terms of what I see out there. And I don't think we're terribly effective in stopping people from going for those fads either. So we're probably not doing a very good job in talking to our own core audience, which must be HRM and HR practitioners who are within reach of our professional publications or academic publications as well. So I don't share Dick's optimism and I wish I did, but it seems that we've got quite a lot of work to do.
It does sound as if to an extent that you're saying very similar things, which is we have a much stronger base of research than we had 20, 25 years ago, that we do have access to new theories that are being tested out through research. But our challenge is influencing the world of practice.
I agree. I think that will be, that's just part of the whole deal of being an applied discipline. We will learn from practice about new excellent tools. We will learn through research about new knowledge and theory, as well as the systematic study of our tools. But to get them embedded back into actual practice, this challenge and this conversation will take place 20 years from now, because I think that is a continuing challenge, and there'll be ups and downs. I mean, in the United States of America, if you're out in the private sector, you know, you're looking at pursuing performance with or without HRD. There are a lot of ways to get to be successful. And they don't all require human resource development.
I think Dick said something really important there, which is there are lots of ways of pursuing performance in organizations which don't have to involve HRD. And I think the root of my concern is that they plainly don't at the moment. And that might be the majority of them. And that's going to need a shift of thinking also in order to bring HRD back into the discussion point within organizations as well.
It's almost as if HRD, as we talk about it, feels like this almost untapped potential.
It feels to me like an untapped resource in a hostile environment. And I guess that's the way I would think about it in terms of how it sits in a lot of organizations and a lot of economic systems as well, currently. And until that environment changes, then I don't think you untap the potential of HRD again.
Well, I believe that people in our profession should become students of their host organizations and look at its goals, its missions. It looked at the sources of pain, of lost opportunities, and then go back to say, how could HRD contribute to this organization based upon what the organization needs and wants and aspires to? And if we just sit there on the other side of the wall waiting for the organization to jump over or call and say, we need you, that's a fairly impotent position to take. And so we need to become partners at the highest level with our host organizations so that we can align what we do and propose interventions that have important potential outcomes for that organization.
One of the things that didn't crop up much in our conversation, one-to-one conversations, was the role of nations and international bodies in the history of HRD. So I'd be interested to explore that a little.
I think there are some nations which have been very heavily interventionist in terms of national skills building, and that's absolutely fine. It's something about their own history as a nation, about the time that the nation might have come into being, about particular needs that that organization or nation needed. So you'll see in lots of different countries, different national models and intervention styles around skills building. I think my experience of kind of Commonwealth nations, kind of the Anglo element of the Commonwealth, is that they have for a long time been under the shadow of the UK legal and employment systems. And that has thrown up a certain similarity in the way that organizations and national governments approached skills, things like apprenticeship schemes, the idea of crafts, unions, the interaction of those particular bodies. But that's changed perhaps in the last 20 or 30 years as different nations have looked at residual or legacy systems around apprenticeships and skills training and have gone their own way. And Australia certainly broke away from what looked like the UK model in the 1990s when it started talking about competency-based vocational training and overhauled its systems, not entirely successfully, I think, but certainly tried to look at different ways. Germany has certainly got a different history around vocational training and the role of the state and industries and unions in organizing craft and trade apprenticeships. So there's a lot that a lot of different nations do, which are really important. And people who are sitting in those countries and learning about HRD and also practicing HRD will be influenced by those histories and by how that plays out in contemporary times and contemporary society.
Well, certainly Germany has been the most visible model about apprenticeship programs for a long time period. And I look at South Africa, the concept of Mbutu, of people gathering together in kind of a council reflective environment where with using this easy and respectful exchange among people in groups come to what they believe to be the best decisions. And I know that Mbutu has influenced a number of organization development tools that are used throughout the world. So I think that you could go down the list of countries and say, hey, what is an aspect that that comes from this nation that adds value to the human resource development profession? And those are just a couple of them.
Excellent. Well, I think we've reached our final question for the discussion. And I'd like to wrap up by asking what hints and tips you've got for the listeners who want to learn more about the history and foundations of HRD. What would you recommend, or what have you found useful yourselves that listeners could tap into to learn more?
Well, I want everybody to purchase my third edition of the Foundations of Human Resource Development.
It was a shameless plug, Dick. I love it.
There are rival textbooks that do a nice job of presenting the foundations of the field. So I think that we have a fair amount of print material. The disconnect between the foundations and actual practice requires that you get out of your seat and go see. If only to go for informational interviews or to observe what's going on, that whole theory to practice, you need to have a leg in both camps.
So I guess my tip would be curious about the origins of the practice that you are being told about. So go read about it. Get curious about why the things that we take for granted are this way. How is it that we take them for granted? And go poke about and be curious and be challenging and find out something that's going to change your practice today and challenge how you think about things. And that's what history is for. That's why the history of HRD is really important, because we have to question the origins of our practice. And we might find out really interesting things along the way. And we might practice differently. We might be the start of that new innovation or that new way of thinking about things.
Excellent. Well, we've reached the end of our time for today. A big thank you to both of you for our conversations and for being part of our discussion on the history and foundations of HRD. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
It's been fun, Darren. Thank you.
Thank you so much for joining me for this episode. It was wonderful spending time with Dick and with Linda. If you enjoyed the episode, check out our others to explore topics such as training and development, learning organizations, career development, and much more. New episodes release weekly for this first series of 10 episodes. To learn more about the series, check out hrdmasterclass.com. And to learn about the Academy of Human Resource Development, check out ahrd.org. By becoming a member, you can access extra bonus materials not included in the podcast. Also, don't forget to look into our group discussion sponsor, Interpretive Simulations, by visiting their website at interpretive.com. I'm looking forward to being with you in our next episode. Until then, this is Darren Short, signing off from the HRD Masterclass. HRD Masterclass Podcast is brought to you by the Academy of Human Resource Development and is a production of allbypodcast.com.